leadership is inherently problematic, right? This idea of somebody being in charge of other people and others being considered less than, it's what our society has been established upon, but it's inherently problematic. So it inherently comes with a lack of psychological safety.
This is Leaderful, where we give you the models and the frameworks, the strategies and the skills that you need to drive true transformation for yourself, your team, your organization, and the world. Welcome to the show. Okay, welcome back to another episode of Leaderful. I'm one of your hosts, Jeff Coulard, and for today, we have a very special guest. I'm excited to dig into a variety of topics with her. But before we do that, I wanted to give a shout out to some listeners across the world. Actually, we've got listeners in Ireland and the UK and Puerto Rico. So thank you. Wherever you're tuning in from, we appreciate you, and we appreciate you taking time out of your day to be in meaningful conversation with us. And on that note, we would love for this podcast to continue to evolve into a conversation, not just between us or between us and our guests, but with you, the listener. And so if you have questions, if you have comments, if you have things, topics that you want us to dig into or guests that you think we should bring onto the show, we'd love to hear from you. You can go to www.theallyco.world and just hit use the contact form and send us a note or find us on LinkedIn and send us a note there. All right, let's talk about today's guest. Her name is Jennifer Velez. She is a mom, an international traveler, a leader, someone who's got a depth and breadth of experience in the DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion space. And with that brings a wealth of insights to this conversation where we dig into things like psychological safety and unhealthy conflict and power and how power shows up in relationship. And so I hope you enjoy this conversation half as much as I did with Jennifer, and let us know. Drop us a rating or a review if you enjoy the show. And without further ado, Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Of course. Thank you for having me. Happy to dive into this conversation with you today.
For those of you who are listening, Jennifer and I are looking at a slide that has eight different problems. We call them problems, but or opportunities for workplaces to improve the employee experience. Things like deep stuckness and chronic burnout and unhealthy conflict, misused power, all of these different things that we'd like to think, I think, often are separate somehow from each other, but they're actually very interconnected, or at least we see them as being interconnected on teams. And I'd love to get your take on some of these, some of your experiences, and we'll hopefully get to some things, you know, some practical things that leaders can do in this space to improve the experience of these for their employees from where you sit in the organization and your experiences. And so thank you again for being here. Where do you want to start? This is like a choose your own adventure with Jeff.
Let's see. Let's start with unsafe environments. It's one of my favorites. Okay. My least favorite favorites.
Your least favorite favorites. Why is that? Why is it your favorite?
It's so common, right? Sadly, more common than safe environments are. If I think back through my journey of life, workplace, school place, unsafe environments are, yeah, just more common. We experience a lack of safety, and I feel like we are almost socialized to think that that is the norm, and that is okay to not feel safe. And, you know, we have things like, you know, I have a labor union background, and we have things like OSHA that regulate physical safety, but we don't really have any governing body of any kind that regulates psychological safety. And I just feel like it's some of us more than others, right? But there's just an immense amount of lack of psychological safety.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about and dig into that, you know, some of us more than others, because I'm generally speaking probably on the upside of the feeling safe paradigm, being, you know, in leadership roles, being a white male, being lots of things that, you know, there's lots of power that I hold. I've pushed for a long time for us to consider the other side of psychological safety. We don't have to talk about it, right? We just talk about psychological safety as if it exists. And from a leader's perspective, because they feel safe, they usually think that things are safer than they are. So, you know, this takes us right into leadership and power and how that shows up in the workplace. What's the connection there for you to safety, particularly psychological safety? But you make a great point on, you know, we take physical safety really seriously, or you know, more seriously, probably. There's, like you say, there's regulations or there's, you know, some sort of governance around it anyway. Psychological safety, yeah, why don't we have that in place? And what, from your perspective, what can we do about it, or what's missing there for you?
Yeah, why don't we? Huh, that's a deep question. That's probably a whole PhD right there. At least it was part of mine. Why don't we have it? I want to say the first word that popped in my brain when you said that is stigma, actually. I know that you have a mental health background, right? So you probably more than me even are aware of the stigma that exists around mental health. We live in a society that doesn't see mental health as being important or equivalent to that of physical health. And I think that that rolls into the workplace very much, right? When we talk about, even the term psychological safety is newer to the workplace, right? Where people are just starting now to like sometimes feel comfortable even using that term. But it's just, if you are experiencing any type of psychological discomfort, you're considered weak if you say anything about it. It's toughen up, deal with it. Work is going to be hard. It's going to be stressful, et cetera. What can we do about it? We need to talk to people and connect. That's always like my thing, is connecting with other people, right? It's not sensitivity training. It's not just being kind to one another. It's like truly trying to connect. And when I think of leadership, this is probably, not too progressive for this space, but probably too progressive for most workplaces. Leadership is inherently problematic, right? This idea of somebody being in charge of other people and others being considered less than, it's what our society has been established upon, but it's inherently problematic. So it inherently comes with a lack of psychological safety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. The fact that connection was the first thing that kind of popped into your mind as a solution for that, because we often refer to it, that up and down power dynamic that you're alluding to, where we have people in positions of power for often no good reason other than they happen to be men or white or whatever. And the down power, so up and down power, it's very easy to create what's called the dynamic of disconnection, right? Where you're in a down power role, you don't have as much power and influence. It's vulnerable to say that I feel unsafe. And so you nod your head and you smile as if everything's fine, and you send the signal up the chain that everything is fine. And so people keep doing the things that are oppressive or misuses of power. And we get this, this entrenched kind of cycle, this disconnecting dynamic. I'd love your take on, like, when you're in one of those side of that dynamic, what can you do? So when you're in the up power dynamic, how do you resolve that tension that is, I don't know if people are telling me the truth about their experience because of where I sit in the organization or how I'm perceived with my power. Any thoughts on what people in up power leadership roles can do to just kind of crack that?
Yeah. So I had a previous leader earlier in my career who truly, he was a leader, right? He was the director. He was in charge of all the things. But he truly empowered each of us on the team to be our own leader and be in a leadership role from where we were, right? He didn't believe that all of the leader inherently belonged to him by title. Yes, that power was there. And he acknowledged that is very real. We can't just pretend it doesn't exist. But he truly listened to us and encouraged us to speak up and make decisions. And he led in a community type style, right? And you referenced before about typically it's white males that are in the leadership roles and everybody else isn't, and the down power positions is kind of saved for everybody else. When I think of cultural components of that, right, there are a lot of cultures that organize their society in a community style. And when you lead in I feel like that's almost doesn't make sense, lead in a community style, but when you operate, right, in a community style where everybody has a voice and everybody, is allowed to speak up and, share their thoughts, you're going to get a different outcome, right? And those power dynamics are still there just because of, at least in the US, like 400 plus years of of living this way. But that's a good place to start, right? Like allowing people the space. Are people still going to feel uncomfortable being vulnerable? Absolutely. But I think when a leader is okay being vulnerable themselves, you create a space where other people feel it is okay to be vulnerable also. I always say that I don't necessarily, fit into that place because I'm probably more outspoken than I should be. By nature of who I am as a person, my ADHD, oversharing, and being in the DEI space, I think that is a power that I have privilege of, right? I often say that I can say the thing, whatever the thing is, and there's probably going to be, problems with what I said or clapback for what I said, but I'm protected by this umbrella and in visual energy of DEI that I'm supposed to be the one saying and doing the thing, so it's okay.
Yeah, it's part of your role power, right? So each roles have, you know, expectations of them. And if people expect the DEI person to broach the tough conversations, then you do have some cover there, right? I'd love to take us down a little bit of a side bunny trail, because an earlier episode of this podcast was the problem with vulnerability is the title of it. I think it's episode 3 or 4. Pablo and I were discussing ways in which we've seen vulnerability misused and kind of weaponized in the workplace. I'd love your perspective on that, because you alluded to vulnerability being a key here. And I just wanted, from your perspective, when you're in a leadership role, what does good vulnerability look like? And have you ever seen vulnerability misused by people in positions of power? And just your take on that.
Yeah. In the DEI space, I think the most common place or most common way that I see vulnerability being misused is this idea that queer, brown, and Black people should be sharing their deeply personal traumatic experiences and stories for other people to learn from. And while personal stories, I think, are really powerful in creating change, they're often weaponized and used in a way that, you know, that's all we're there for. We're there to, you know, share our traumatic stories. Are you inviting me to the conversation because I'm a bisexual woman who was outed in a country where it was illegal and you want to hear about that? Or are you doing that because you think it makes you look good as, you know, as a leader because you've invited me to the conversation? It's different, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the most common way that I see vulnerability being misused is that in that type of way where it is, you know, made to be like this sexy thing in a way. Vulnerability being used in a good way, I think just being honest, right? Like saying what we're thinking in, of course, a way that is, you know, safe for the listener as well. I always say that I come from this place of like, if I'm not telling you the whole truth, with all the details, I feel like I'm lying to you, right? Withholding information is also a lie in as far as how I stand, right? And so if we are being vulnerable and we are saying, you know, this is how I feel about this situation, this is how I view this situation, rather than withholding that information, that creates a space where other people, like I said, hopefully feel that they can do that too. And it's not going to be like instant, right? Like a leader's not going to walk into a room, have no rapport built with people and say like, this is how I view the situation and this is how I feel. And then everybody else is going to jump in, right?
funny story. That's how I've seen vulnerability misused before. It was literally a first meeting. A leader had just been hired, walked into the room and was just kind of puked their vulnerability out into the space. And you could just see the whites of people's eyes like, oh no, like now I'm responsible for this person, something. I don't know what, right? Aren't you the leader? Like, why am I responsible for holding your stuff? Right. And so that's, you know, I can see it being misused in lots of different ways, but it is so essential to human connection, right? Is that we are honest with each other. And I guess that takes us a layer down into the connection and disconnection. Like what's the state of that in the world these days from your perspective, and what's driving some of that disconnection or connection, like either side of that coin? Because that's something, you know, we talk about cultural disconnection as one of those indicators of workplace health. Thoughts on that?
Drivers of disconnection. It's strange because I would say the pandemic is both a driver of disconnection and a driver of connection. It's done this strange thing where it has shrunk many of our circles, right? We are physically interacting with less people than we might normally. And because we were in, you know, this lockdown space in place for so long, we were just literally not connecting with other people outside of our home. We have gotten used to being more closed off to other people. Connecting with people in a virtual space isn't the same as connecting with people in, you know, a physical space. It's not that I'm, you know, so pro of going back to the workplace. I don't want anybody to think that either. working from home is great. There is a way to connect with people virtually, but we just are not socialized to do that because it's not how we have typically done things, right? Like it will take time to establish that culture. So when we are in this new place and space of how we're working and how we are more close off to other people, that's naturally going to fall into leader space too, right? If we think of who are primarily the leaders who have access to being a leader and the privilege of being a leader, right? Or gets identified to be a leader because of their privilege, right? Those are two different things. Mm-hmm. People, I don't know. I feel like people are going to not necessarily connect in the same way, right? And so it's going to require leadership to do something different to increase that connection, right? You can't just have like these water cooler chats like you used to have, right? As we refer to them, and maybe for the good or for the bad, but there's requires more energy And I feel like we just have less of it in this world, right? Or we are reserving our energy for things that we feel or are a more powerful way of spending that time and energy. Yeah, I feel like I really got off topic there from that. I had an idea. I don't know if I really expressed it.
That's what this podcast is for. It's to go down bunny trails and have half. It's all good. Yeah, it makes me think of the like this belief maybe that a lot of leaders have that the office was working fine prior to the pandemic, and we just need to go back to that because it's working fine for them in their position of power. They were getting their connection needs met all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And there's probably been a, I don't know if it's true or if there's data to reflect this, but a decline in curiosity, right? Of people actually being curious about the experiences of other people. And that's such a core ingredient of using our power well when we do have power, is to actually be genuinely curious about someone else's experience. Because if we were, we might find that the water cooler chats are not what people find connecting. They find them stressful or whatever, right? And the reality is that each of us are going to have an individual perspective on that. And the system doesn't like that kind of one size fits one approach. It loves the one size fits all, you know, let's just blanket policy this. So that's, I think, if we slide over into some of the other kind of challenges in the workplace or problems, we find this misuses of power bucket, which really finds it like misuses of power are often very subtle. Oftentimes don't look like misuses of power because from my perspective, you know, it's working fine, right? Everybody's coming into the office and they're smiling, right? They're not telling me that they're stressed out or frustrated or, you know, don't have childcare, so they're scrambling every day or like whatever it is that's driving that. We have this expectation, I guess, is that it works for me and it's going to work for everybody. Now I'm rambling. I'm trying to form a question. What do you wish leaders knew about connection that you know about connection?
That's a tough question.
I go on a ramble and then I just drop a tough question on
you. Yeah, exactly. So while you were on your important ramble, I was thinking about, you may have seen that meme that was floating around for a bit on LinkedIn. It's kind of, I call it the rebrand of KPIs, rather than, you know, the typical ways that we are measuring workplace success, right? Profit margins, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It's switching from key performance indicators that are focused on, you know, financial things and switching it to people things, right? And keeping people. So what do I wish that leaders knew that I knew about connection? That the financial gains will come if connecting with people is what you're prioritizing, right? Because when we only focus on what are the monetary gains of whatever situation, and monetary, you know, that could be any type of numbers, right? Maybe you don't work in the finance industry, so maybe it's not numbers specifically, but, or like dollars specifically, but it always equates to dollars eventually, right? Focusing on people will impact your numbers. Always statistically proven, right? But if we are not focusing on the people piece of that, you're inherently creating a culture of disconnection where people are told that they don't matter, even if it isn't a clear message that you're delivering every day. And so you might meet your goals, you might even exceed your goals, but they're not going to stay there long because people are just not happy and they don't feel safe, right? So I don't know that I know any specific secrets about connecting with people and but prioritizing people needs to really be what that is, right? And you mentioned about curiosity. How I see curiosity most often being used nowadays in 2022, especially in the DEI space, is like, send out a survey. We need to send out a survey. Let's see how they feel, right? And it's like, I'm a DEI person who, I'll be honest, doesn't always take surveys. I don't know how to be dishonest on a survey. I have to be honest, like in most situations. So I'll just avoid your survey and won't take it. And I feel like I shouldn't even publicly admit that because I'm often the person who's like, take the survey.
Reminder, your survey is good.
Exactly. It's going to help drive my programming. But there isn't always honesty or trust, rather, is the word that I'm wanting. There isn't always trust that survey is going to truly be anonymous, like they say, et cetera. Who has access to the data? How are they using the data? And even when leaders tell you, like, this is how we're going to use the data, it's like, that's great. But I don't trust you on a regular Tuesday. I'm especially not going to trust you on a Thursday where you're asking me to pour out all of my feelings about the workplace. Yeah. Is this how you're trying to quiet fire me? Trying to figure out, you know, how I really feel about this place. So the trust has to be there, and you're not going to build trust with people just by, again, focusing on numbers. You truly need to connect with people and do it in a genuine way. It's not just like, have a great Thanksgiving this week, you know, isn't the only way that you connect with people. It's like, hey, I heard your son was in the hospital. How is he doing? Is there anything that we can do at work this week that would better accommodate, you know, your life and your schedule? Is there something that you need? It's more of those situations where you are truly connecting with people with what matters to them as individuals, because it looks different for every person, right? Mm-hmm. And you're not going to, when I think of the purpose of surveys, right? It's try to like, what are the main areas that we need to focus on? Whatever the thing is, whatever, you know, we're trying to accomplish. Even with surveys, you're going to miss out on a lot of those individualized perspectives and experiences, because that's not really what they're there for. They're really, what is like the most, where are the responses the most? So you're going to focus on that. You're not going to focus on an individual and, you know, their specific lived experience.
You know, we could go down the survey bunny trail. I think actually this week or last week, it must have been last week's podcast, Pablo and I went on a 30-minute rant about the problems with employee engagement surveys, and like, you're ticking some boxes here. It's like, yeah. And it does come down to trust and connection, right? And I guess, and actually there's some interesting stats out of, I forget the group, but there's some, like an annual trust survey that comes out, and trust across the board is at an all-time low here in 2022 of our institutions, our governments, our, you know, academia, scientists, but the workplace too is suffering. And so, you know, that's, again, goes back to that, like, so interconnected, these issues of power and psychological safety and trust and connection and belonging. At what point, and this is something I, like a little sidetrack now into the DEI space, which is your expertise, definitely not mine, acronyms, language, understanding, like shared understanding of language. How important is that? And how can we get to a place of shared understanding of language? Because, you know, I often struggle with that. I just had an epic LinkedIn thread with somebody about power. They wanted to replace the word power with something else. I was like, no. We're not going to replace words. We're going to rehabilitate them if you have a negative bias towards them or whatever, right? But how do you approach that? Or what have you seen be successful in the space of shared understanding of some of these key words or language?
Good question. So I think of, you know, for example, I know that you're a parent. So when you tell your child to not do something, and you repeatedly tell them not to do it, you don't really make much gains until you help them understand why. Why are we not doing that, right? When you explain, I mean, I don't know your children specifically, but just, you know, human psychology, when they are taught the reason why something is problematic or dangerous or unsafe, they're less likely to engage in it in the future rather than you just telling them, right? So what that has to do with language for me is undergrad, I studied colonization. I would say that much of my passion and understanding about the DEI space comes from colonization. And I feel like if we really truly focus in and hone in on colonization, then we will just by nature be more empathetic people, because we realize the world we live in and you know, how we have each participated in creating the society that we have today. But when colonization first happened, I usually tell people, like, try to teach people about this little lesson. When colonization was first happening, one of the tools was taking language away from people, right? Whether that was enslaved people, not allowing them to connect and communicate in their own language, whether that was, the indigenous people refusing to allow them, you know, placing their kids in resident schools where they weren't allowed to use their own language. Language has power, and most often it is used in a way where we are disempowering somebody by taking their language away. I think that language has the ability and the power to, you know, switch it on the other side, right? Words exist. They were created. We can create new words all the time. Words, they shift in meaning over time, right? So yeah, to your point, there are a lot of acronyms in the DEI space, right? I mean, DEI, right? I'm using an acronym right there for that. Teaching people the words is important. Helping them understand how to use the words is important, but teaching them the why, I think, is really important, right? Like, I had a colleague reach out to me yesterday and say, what is the right way to refer to the LGBTQ community? Should I say LGBTQ, or is there something else should I say? Should I add, you know, the plus symbol? As a member of that community, I said, I personally am okay with LGBTQ because I know what people mean, but I do get a little bit like cringy when I see it, because I'm like, oh, but what about asexual people and intersex people? And like, there are so many other people, right? So like, the plus symbol is especially important, but the I and A, those are two groups within the community that are often left out, right? So yeah, language has power to build connection, but we need to be careful about who is the person getting to decide how that language is used, and who is implementing the language, who's creating the language, who's getting to decide what it means. if it's only the person in within the power position, then more times than not, language is using as a, is being used as a way to disempower others.
So important. Not to make this a language podcast about that, but it's an area of passion for me, because I think I realized fairly early on in my career doing addiction and mental health work with young people, is how you define the problem and who gets to define the problem is a really important part of the puzzle. Because when people in positions of power, you know, when a young person's parents say the problem is this child's behavior, right? Mm-hmm. And the child, when you ask them what the problem is, they're like, well, it's the abuse that I suffered at the hands of my father, or it's the childhood trauma that I'm trying to navigate. And it's like, oh, and then the police officer has a different perspective and the teacher has a different perspective and everybody's trying to name a problem and accept the person that's actually living the problem, right? Mm-hmm. Or living the consequences of that problem existing, or the bearing the brunt of it, I would say. I think that's, you know, I see it. I see no one person bears the full brunt usually. Like there's an effect where we're connected. We can't, your pain is my pain. Like there's a piece of that you can't exist in relationship and not, you know, be connected in that way. Yeah. Defining the problem. How do you see that playing itself out in the DEI space? Like how are leaders conceptualizing the problems, and do you in your practice, how do you center the voices of the people who historically maybe are marginalized or oppressed or bearing the brunt of those, defining those problems?
Yeah, that's most often what I see from leaders, right? Like I always say, I wouldn't have a job if this wasn't the case, and maybe I just need to accept it. But most often what I see from leaders is they're defining the problem in a way that says this is going to impact business, this is going to impact sales, right? Again, it always comes down to profit and money, profit margins. And it isn't often being looked at like, well, how did this negative situation, for example, impact people? How are they feeling about this thing that happened? And you're not going to know that unless you're, you know, asking. And it's not okay for everybody to ask, right? Like, because if you don't have rapport built with that person, they're not going to want to share. Like, you know, that whole survey thing that we've cycled through before, I'm not going to take us back down that bunny hole. But it isn't just, you know, like a one size fits all approach, kind of like what I was saying before about the individuality. And it isn't just one thing a leader can do that is going to fix this, right? It's not, it's a whole plethora of things that need to be done in the right measures at the same time. It's very difficult, right? Like, I don't want to make it ever sound like it's easy, and because it isn't. But it does require that people have deep self-awareness, right? How are they impacting other people? And realizing how they are impacted by things can also help them with empathy and see how other people might be impacted by things, or at the very least, connect with other people to ask them, you know, how they're impacted by things, and build that culture where the person feels comfortable to talk about how they're impacted by things. So that's, you know, one example. And then another thing is, you're right, it is often the people in power, which means it's not the historically marginalized people that are getting to define the problems. But that's also because there's a lack of us in leadership roles, right? Again, leadership is inherently problematic, but it exists as a society that we live in, and we have to operate in the confines of it for now anyway, right? Until, you know, a mass revolution comes. But in the meantime, if we are only allowing those to have role power, right? So leadership roles within a company or something like this, who also have other types of power, societal power, relational power, et cetera, you're just going to continue to cycle through the same problems. I'm not saying that means just give out leadership roles to historically marginalized people and our problems are going to go away, right? Because that's not the case either. But if you are trying to figure out how a problem is impacting a Black male, and there are no Black males or Black women or Black non-binary persons in the room, you're not going to get there, probably, right? and if you're not asking the specific who is impacted, you're definitely not going to get there, because, you know, no group is a monolith and can speak for everybody. But yeah, really observing, you know, who's in the room, who gets to be part of the conversation, who are you inviting? Like, how is your own personal bias impacting who you're inviting, at least to the conversation? There's so many different ways that shows up.
Yeah, it's... We could go down any one of these rabbit holes for the rest of our conversation. What's alive for you in this conversation, or what do you hope we talk about next?
Unhealthy conflict. So we didn't actually speak much about that.
Okay.
Specifically, I think people have a problem with the word conflict in general, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, all of these things, as we said before, are very interconnected, but unhealthy conflict is problematic. But I think worse than unhealthy conflict is avoiding conflict at all. And I feel like there's this dynamic that has been, you know, we have been socialized to believe, and leaders more often not believe it, that as leaders, they know the best way, they, you know, and we're not supposed to challenge that. We're not supposed to speak against that. We're not supposed to say anything different than what they have decided. That is because of a lack of psychological safety, right? We are not supposed to do those things. I do them. I do them often. It creates a lot of problems for me, but I continue to do it because I feel like nothing's going to change if we don't, right? Yeah. So that's just conflict in general. Like, but if you want to talk specifically about unhealthy conflict, I'm going to let you jump in with a question before I ramble about.
your rambles are great. And when we talk about unhealthy conflict, we include artificial harmony in that, which is what I hear you saying. When you say people avoiding conflict, it's that surface level, you know, everybody's in the meeting and they're nodding their heads and smiling at whatever the leader's saying. And then you leave that meeting and you're like, well, that was stupid, or that was like ridiculous, or like the truth comes out in the
time. You know,
waste of everybody's time. So that unhealthy conflict is like unproductive conflict. So it can be loud and visible. And, you know, we see sometimes email wars back and forth, or, you know, BCCing people in, or like all those behaviors that make conflict kind of unhealthy. And we see just a lack of conflict. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means it's popping out in other ways in the system that aren't helpful. So with that, you know, we talk about productive conflict being that type of conflict that it's visible. Everybody can see it. We have the same language for it. Back to that idea of shared language. Like we're all talking about the same problem, right? I don't think that you're the problem. You don't think I'm the problem. We see the problem as being somewhere in the relationship or somewhere between us. And we have the skill and we use it as an opportunity to, you know, work together, to communicate better, or to be innovative and try new things, or whatever it might look like, but to move conflict into being more functional for the team or the organization so it doesn't get stuck. So with that kind of artificial harmony, unhealthy conflict, what do you see more of? Do you see more artificial harmony than you do unhealthy conflict?
Oh, goodness. I'm trying to think. I definitely see both of those more present than I do see healthy conflict. That is for certain. I see them more so as a progression rather than two separate things. There's usually an abundance of artificial harmony that eventually, you know, no matter who you are over time, if you're not allowed to express what you truly think and feel, it's eventually going to bubble up to the surface, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to spill out. And it's often in places where there has been artificial harmony for so long, there's this dynamic created that people feel they're not allowed to share the truth, or go against the, you know, the status quo. So then what happens, those feelings bubble up, and then you end up with the unhealthy conflict. It's the, as per my last email, it's the, it's all of those things, right? I don't know which one I see more. I feel like at this point in time in 2022, I think that I probably see more unhealthy conflict than I do artificial harmony, just because as the world has shifted, right? Pandemic, all of these other ways that we are, you know, like finally talking about the problem, not everybody, but a lot of us are talking about the problem. More people feel like they can talk about it too. So they're speaking up and speaking out. But because we don't live in a society that says, you know, this is what conflict is truly, and this is like conflict is okay, and it's not a personal attack. And I mean, it can be, but that's unhealthy conflict, right? What is conflict? Conflict means that you can have the conversation with another person and you can say the thing, and that, you know, as you described before, the problem is separate from the humans that are involved in it. These are not skills that we're taught in school. These are not, you know, like all of the life skills we truly needed, like taxes and conflict, we didn't learn in school. Gen Z is learning it in school, and that's why I always say they're going to be the future. But yeah, I don't know which one I see more of, but I will say that if we were making a curve or a graph rather, there would definitely be a curve upwards for unhealthy conflict being more present today.
Yeah, no, I think I agree. I think when I look into, and I'm obviously in a bubble, as far as I know that other people, I can post something on LinkedIn and you can post something on LinkedIn and you'll bring out all of the conflict and all of the haters with the other opinions, and I won't, right? Shocking. I don't know why, like what could possibly be happening there, nothing to do with status or privilege or any of those things. But, you know, I don't get a lot of hate mail for the things that I put on LinkedIn, even when I'm being punchy about patriarchy or whatever. So there's that. I think that there's more conflict online, like that don't read the comment section is true. Like we should just stop reading the comment section. And yet I've had some interesting you know, going into some of those places and going in and like intentionally putting my defenses aside and being curious in those spaces and asking questions to get clarity. I've had some actually really great engaging things that turned into dialogue that went from like us shouting at each other or potentially us shouting at each other to us actually talking about what's meaningful. And that for me, like I have a bit of hope around the fact that conflict is more visible in society. Like you can, you know, objectively speaking, there's been some pretty bad things happening in politics and the world in general, but it's making visible what's been just under the surface for so long in our society. So there is a, you know, unhealthy conflict. If it leads to healthy conflict, like if we can get through it to the other side, that's a helpful thing. If we get stuck there, obviously that's not good for anybody. So I've got a little bit of hope around conflict, but where do you have hope in the DEI space? Or when you look at your work and you look at the work more broadly in the world, where do you go to find some hope and some excitement?
I feel like that is a constantly evolving and changing, right? When I speak to other colleagues in the DEI space, not colleagues in my workplace, but, you know, global colleagues in the DEI space, I feel like from day to day to week to week, it changes, right? Some days I'm filled with hope and I'm like, okay, this we're doing this and we're doing it well. And yes, it's hard, but we're going to do it. And some days I feel hopeless if I'm, you know, being completely honest, it's not continuous. So some days more than other, I really need to dig into that place of like, how can I find the hope? And I think I pushed myself to do that more so for so long. But I think what therapy honestly has really helped me do is sometimes just sit with the, okay, this really sucks. And I don't know what to do right now. And I don't know how this is going to change or if it's ever going to change, and allowing those feelings to wash over me too. So I know that that's the opposite of what you asked me, but I feel like it's important to acknowledge. But trying to find hope, honestly, looking to Gen Z a lot. I started my career working in policy and advocacy for a reproductive health organization. And it was at a very early age, protesting, spending a lot of time in Washington, D.C. and fighting, right? It was all about conflict. It was constantly about conflict. I don't know if the other team is even listening. So maybe it's not conflict if they're not even not even paying attention. But I was so full of hope then because I was just young, right? And unaware about all of the stuff that I would experience and that would happen in life and where the world is today. As I've gotten older and have experienced more, I think that I look more to future generations, right? I know that it is likely that I will not see true equity and inclusion in my lifetime. It's not likely. But what I can do is lay the groundwork as much as I can and use as much of my energy that I have to give to fighting the systems, right? And trying to flip the paradigm, but really encouraging and looking to Gen Z, because I think that they'll probably see it in their lifetime. I really truly believe that. I think that we have been doing the work and laying the groundwork and yes, it's going to take time and it's going to be very hard to get there. But yeah, on those days that I'm really struggling and I'm feeling hopeless, I'm like, all right, let me read about what Gen Z is doing. You know, like what digital activists, like, I mean, they're creating new ways to create new movements and they're doing it in different ways than, you know, we did when we were younger, right? What are they doing? What is going on today? And where is Gen Z on the internet doing something that is so interesting that I would have never thought to do that is helping chip away at the problem, even if it's a small chipping away, just because they seem to, you know, by nature of being young, have so much like zest for life and belief that things are going to get better and a demand for it to be better. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just because they're younger and I'm old, but I really believe that there are hope for the future. Mm-hmm. As cheesy as that sounds.
Yeah. And you're not that old. Like the fight's not, not gone too far. Yeah, it's interesting. I think that if we think of like information as power, mm-hmm. there's more information at our fingertips than there ever has been. It continues to like that has accelerated. And so when I think of, you know, maybe my parents would have been in that kind of baby boomer generation where life was actually pretty good. There wasn't a lot of information about the ways in which things were not good. Right. And so there's lots of like, we were kind of cocooned. I'm a millennial. And so I'm in that generation that's looking at the like, wait a minute, like I'm working really hard and I'm not as far along in life as my parents certainly were at this age. Yeah. Right. And so what's that about? And yet still, I think there's enough of that, like, I don't know whether it's the like capitalism, work hard to get ahead, bootstrap kind of mindset that we could spend an entire podcast probably on the problem with grit and resiliency and bootstrap, that narrative as something. But I'm seeing that kind of starting to fade away into a more collective, and maybe it's individualistic versus collective is what it comes down to. I do think that there's more, or at least there's conversations and there's more information. I'm hearing more about sociocracy these days and holacracy and some of these other ways of governing outside of the traditional command and control that I ever have. And so that's encouraging, you know, starting to creep into the mainstream a little bit. And so, you know, I would say I look to those spaces for hope too. And I like who's actually building alternative ways of governing and making decisions and some of these things, because we've inherited this, you know, this top-down hierarchy kind of model out of the military, and colonialism and all of these places. And we just kind of run it as the default. And so starting to see that start to fracture a little bit. So there's some hope there for sure. What haven't we talked about today that you hoped we would talk about? It's that classic interview question of like, tell me what I didn't ask you so I can.
Yeah. What didn't we talk about that we should speak about? You know, it's coming to mind actually. So, you know, you spoke about LinkedIn, right? And the messages that we get are different from our posts, right? Like what's conflict, what isn't. Another thing that is really common, especially in the social media space, specifically LinkedIn, is people reaching out about wanting to get into the DEI space because they're passionate about the work, which I both love and cringe at equally. And the reason for that is because there's so many people wanting to do the work that they don't realize that it's not the work. It's everybody's work, right? It's a collective. It's a collective problem. It's a collective. We all need to target it and support it, et cetera. And this idea that it's just the DEI person's job to create the change is inherently problematic and isn't going to get us anywhere, except for a lot of burnout for DEI professionals, which maybe I'm speaking out of turn and unaware here, but I probably think it's higher than many other fields.
It's huge. I listened to a panel conversation with a few folks, Farzine, who I think you might know.
Yeah.
And the average lifespan of a chief diversity officer is less than 3 years, I think. It's like two years, 2.5 years. And we don't see that kind of retention problem in the CEO job or the COO job, right? And so there is that, the system loves to individualize things, right? Mm-hmm. And it's actually, you know, the system can keep perpetuating itself by allowing some DEI conversations to happen through one individual, right? As opposed to looking at it structurally or systemically. It's like, probably Chomsky would talked about the, you know, acceptable debate, right? If you draw the sandbox that you can debate within or protest within, that's the system's way of making sure we don't go outside of those margins and actually affect real change, right? What's acceptable to the system isn't probably going to disrupt the system.
Exactly. Because it's acceptable.
Exactly. It's like, oh, yeah, we'll allow this. We'll have to, you know, it'll shave a little bit off the bottom line. Like we'll have to pay some salaries and for some initiatives, we'll celebrate a little bit more, but it, you know, it's not going to functionally change much. So how, as a DEI practitioner, do you go about resolving that tension for you in the role?
Specifically with other leaders, do you mean, or in
connecting? How do you approach that, knowing that even just the role of DEI in most organizations is problematic because it's been individualized and given a job description as opposed to kind of a joint shared mandate potentially to make some meaningful changes? How do you approach navigating that? Because there must be a tension there for you.
Oh yeah, it's tough. I sometimes wish that I could be the person who could just sit back and be like, okay, well, I've got a job. There's that. At least there's that. Just sit back and chill today, right? But by nature of DEI people who we are, right? That's especially if you're a good DEI leader, right? That's not who you are. So I don't know that I necessarily do a good job of resolving that tension. It's more so just acknowledging that it's there and persisting anyway. Trying to call people in as much as possible and make them aware of the issue. You know, I often see myself, even like I had worked in the consulting space for a while, but even when I'm not in the consulting space, when I'm in-house working as a DEI leader, I still am often perceived as a consultant, right? Like you're there for us to like take advice from, or no, not take advice. You're there for us to sometimes listen to, sometimes we'll take your advice, sometimes we'll just ignore you. That's just like the nature. That's inherently why DEI roles are problematic, right? Because they don't have the power, even as a, you know, a chief diversity officer that, like you said, the CEO has, for example. So yeah, how do I address it? calling people in, talking about it, saying the thing. I honestly don't know if it's changing anything or impacting. I think in different environments, it yields different results, but oftentimes it requires me to say the thing and do the thing that's not acceptable. And just saying, well, this is what I'm here for. I'm sorry if you don't like it. Like, I'm not here to make you happy. That's not what I'm here for.
Which inevitably, you know, for people in those roles, those DEI roles, is going to be problematic because you also have connection and belonging needs that you want to get met in the workplace.
Oh, yeah.
Like anybody else. And here you are having to play the role of antagonist in the system potentially.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've said so many times that being the DEI person in a company can often be like the loneliest place in space, right? And not to be on a negative topic since we're like nearing the end here, but it can be the loneliest space in place because there are people who truly are like, I don't want this DEI stuff. Like, I don't want any part of that, right? So oftentimes that's the leaders, ironically, right? Who need me the most, but don't realize it. And yeah, so it's tricky because you, as a DEI person, even though we have our inherent needs that need to be met, we really have to focus on getting them met elsewhere and in a different way, right? Or meeting them ourselves. In some cases, connecting with other DEI leaders, because yeah, it's not common that you can be the person who's always, you know, calling out the problem and saying why it's problematic and that everyone's going to flock to you and be like, oh yeah, this is, we're so happy you're here, right? Unless you're the person who's being harmed by it and who doesn't likely have a voice anyway, because you're being harmed by it, right? Just by the nature of the system. Yeah, you're not going to have many fans as a DEI professional.
Yeah, it goes back to that system level. How are we organizing ourselves? And maybe two more questions if you have time.
Yeah, absolutely. We're good.
First question is, and it was from the panel conversation that I attended at the Right Use of Power conference a couple of weeks ago. The suggestion or the connection was between organizational design and DEI and how those two haven't historically, you know, spent as much time together as they should. But this conversation with you is alluding to that fact that if we took some of these principles, ideals, values, practices, and rolled them into the organizational design space and looked at how we distribute power, look at how we make decisions, look at who has, you know, voices and doesn't, it seems like that is the work ahead of us. If we're going to truly operationalize DEI, you're nodding your head. Does that resonate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I often think that much of the work that we're doing in the DEI space, even though I'm not a performative person, it's always going to essentially be performative until we truly address organizational design, right? In the beginning of the podcast, I said leadership is inherently problematic. And that, you know, is really the key ingredient to organizational design and assessing organizational design, right? I can, you know, run the numbers, see who we're hiring, who we're not hiring, who we're promoting, who we're not promoting. Okay, let's add more Black people to the mix. You got it. Okay, cool. It doesn't matter at the end of the day, right? If we're still creating this like structured paradigm of like who is in charge and who isn't and who gets a say. Organizational design is definitely the work that is ahead of us. I don't think that we're there as a society. It doesn't mean that I personally and a lot of professionals I know are not going to continue to push us towards that place, right? And have the conversation to really rebuild and reestablish what this should all look like. But in my experience, most of the organizations that I have partnered with globally are not there, right? They so much so not there that they don't even realize that that's the conversation that we're truly having, right? They're still like, okay, well, 2020 happened. We watched George Floyd get murdered and now we're willing to talk about DEI. Okay, great. But DEI is really not DEI. It's really organizational design. That's really what we're talking about. Like, if we're not going to talk about power and the role of various powers and how they intersect or don't, we're never going to get anywhere. And when we were talking about language, you mentioned about people flinching to the word power or somebody, a specific example. Yeah, if we can't talk about the words or even say the words, right? Like white supremacy. I've been on a long LinkedIn break because I am so sick of being shadow banned because I use the word white supremacy. People are not even comfortable saying the words that we need to be saying, never mind addressing the problems of why those phrases exist.
Round two of the podcast is organizational design from a DEI and taking on the power dynamics. What advice do you have for someone like me who generally speaking has lots of power in the systems. I'm a consultant, and so I tend to get listened to because of that, the role power, but also the status power that I have, some personal power that I've built over the years. When I'm coming into a system, I never say I do DEI work, and yet I do leadership and power work, which is like they're as adjacent as you can get. You know, you said leadership's problematic, and like, so we're kind of coming at the same problems, or I guess challenges of belonging, inclusion, you know, safety, all of these pieces. What advice do you have for me? What can I think about when I'm going into those spaces that are probably predominantly male, predominantly white, to open up some space for these conversations, to use my power in a way that can affect change? Any parting thoughts for me? Totally selfish. I host these podcasts so I can get free advice from Jennifer.
So like you said, those rooms are probably predominantly white, predominantly male, right? Statistically speaking. And actually, I think that there's another privilege there that, not to judge, maybe you just haven't been aware of, or maybe you're aware of it. And I always think that, you know, there's a lot of people in the DEI space specifically, or like the leadership space, right, who believe that the person stepping in and doing the work to support in a consultant basis shouldn't be a person who has multiple privileges, right? So like having a white male be brought in to have this conversation is problematic. Mm-hmm. I actually don't buy into that narrative and perspective. I think that oftentimes people are willing to listen to you because of who you are, like you said, right? And that piece is important. The number of times that I've stepped into a room as a consultant to share my perspective, and the predominantly white male room is looking at me like I'm insane, and like, yeah, we're definitely not gonna, okay, why did we hire this person kind of perspective is common. So again, that doesn't mean that all people addressing leadership and stepping in as consultants should be, you know, white and male. That's not what I'm saying either. But as far as advice for you, like being vulnerable, again, that word, about the learnings that you've had, right? The Jeff that I know is inherently a good person, right? I don't know if that was always who Jeff was, right? But at any point in your journey, when these different various experiences and learnings have happened, right? Imagining that a lot of it probably came from your time working in mental health and addiction, talking about those things, right? Bringing light to them. This way others can hopefully bring light to their own, you know, situations and learning opportunities, and prescribing everybody therapy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Don't hire an executive coach, go to therapy. That's what you need to do. If you spend those dollars talking to somebody, make it a therapist. Exactly. That's the mic drop moment. We're going to end it there, because I can't think of a better piece of advice for me personally, but also for all the leaders out there to learn more about our power, really, is what that process is, and where that power comes from, and how we conceptualize it, and the impact it has on ourselves and the people in the world. That level, like you say, of self-awareness is important as we work to shift the systems and change some of the structures, for sure. So,
absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I kept you for a full hour, so great conversation. Okay. Really appreciate it. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about the work that you do?
Sure. LinkedIn is a good place. Like I said before, I'm on this brief break between men sliding into my DMs for dinner dates and being shadow banned for white supremacy. I've needed some time to recover. Fair enough. But I am typically quite active on LinkedIn. My name is Jennifer Velez. You probably see it on the bottom of the screen, I think. And it's spelled just like that. Yeah, I hope you come find me and connect with me. Thanks so much. It's always always a pleasure connecting with you, Jeff, whether it's in your Ally Co training sessions. It's always just great to chat with you. And I appreciate you, and I appreciate your time.
Leaderful is brought to you by The Ally Co, a team of human-centered, systems-conscious consultants, coaches, and facilitators dedicated to helping you and your team tackle the core problems of burnout and stuckness and misalignment and misuses of power and all of the things that get in the way of creating truly human-centered workplaces where everyone thrives and does their best work. Head over to www.theallyco.world to learn more.